You're listening to Faith and Reason 360. Support for Faith and Reason 360 comes from the D.L. Deitch Jr. Foundation, the Joe B. and Louise P. Cook Foundation, promoting critical thinking about faith and life, and from listeners like you. By the way, I'm Debo Dykes.
And I'm Ann Phelps. Joining us today in the studio is the Reverend Dr. Jason Coker. Jason is the coordinator for the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship of Mississippi and the national director of Together for Hope and founder of the Delta Hands for Hope, an award-winning nonprofit that provides meals to children around Mississippi in an effort to combat hunger, child poverty, and injustice. A child of poverty in the Mississippi Delta himself, Coker grew to pursue an education that includes an MDiv from Yale Divinity School and a PhD from Drew University. In addition to his ministry and development and engagement work here in Mississippi, he continues his work as a scholar who explores post-colonial theory and critical race theory, particularly regarding the New Testament letter of James. Hello, Jason, and thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a real pleasure to be here. Flattered, excited.
Jason, I grew up in the Deep South in the 60s, and I really thought we had become a welcoming country and a country of acceptance, you know, like our Constitution says, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people. And now, as I look at the carnage in Charlottesville, Virginia, I am sickened by the violence, the exhibition of racism, the intellectual dishonesty that's on display in the United States.
It's one of those days where, you know, a week ago we came with a plan of what we were going to talk to Jason about. And luckily, knowing Jason through our work here and through being friends and our experiences that we shared at Yale, I know that you, Jason, are not afraid to explore hard topics and are also like us, would consider it unconscionable to not just come straight out of the gates and talk about the reality around us that there are some really horrific things happening here. And that something we've been talking about, that perhaps these things have been happening. It's just that suddenly they're more visible to a different group of people than they were before. And what a tough day.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you'd talked to some of your friends here in Mississippi.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of us are shocked by the racism exhibited, the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, the alt-right, whatever name you want to give this horrible racist demonstration. A lot of white people have articulated shock and things like, you know, what era is this? How can this possibly be happening? And I know that there may be, I don't want to speak for all people, but I have not yet heard from a single one of my Black friends or Muslim friends or non-white friends in general, not one of them is shocked. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really telling. Jason, I know you've thought a lot about this.
Yeah, I mean, this is just the same old America a lot of people have been living in all their lives. Mm-hmm. There is no difference. Mm-hmm. It's great that white people are shocked, though. I mean, finally.
Wake up.
Right? We just don't have a good mechanism in white America to articulate issues of race. Mm-hmm. We're not trained to do that. We're afraid to do that.
For so long, we've considered ourselves normal, not raced. Yeah. But white is a race
with
a culture.
With a culture and a language. And to not have to engage in racial discourse is an incredible privilege.
Oh my gosh.
Right? And so this was finally an affront to enough white people to do something, to voice disagreement about it. And I think just that the volume of Confederate battle flags and Nazi flags really hurt people. And today, I got off the phone today with a guy named Dr. Joe Cooper. He was a professor in philosophy and religion at MC for decades. Mm-hmm. He's 94 years old. He was a navigator in bombers during World War II, shot down in Italy, and marched to Germany about 40 days before then. And I called Dr. Cooper, and I said, Dr. Cooper, I thought about you with all the Nazi flag stuff. How'd you deal with that? And he was just, it was hard for him to talk about it. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. he's 94 years old. Yeah. And that he was in that war so long ago, and this was devastating.
Jason, you had, I'm sorry, Ann, do you want to?
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Jason, you had, you wrote an article last January, just this past January, for the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, CBF, and it was titled Liminal Whiteness. Mm-hmm. And I think our listeners would be very interested if you would talk about that and tell us about the article and what your experience was. I think, Ann, you were going to ask him to segue right into your growing up in the Delta mm-hmm. in Mississippi.
Well, I think it's both of those things all at once. I mean, the liminal is certainly this place in between. That's kind of what the nature of what liminality is. And I grew up poor in the Mississippi Delta, and I was white. So in my age, most white kids went to private schools, except for the poor kids who couldn't afford it. So I got to go to public schools and was, you know, there were white people in the school, but it was just not that many of them. And there wasn't one day I lived my life that I did not know I was white. There was no way to live and breathe in that experience, being the only white or a couple of white kids in my class.
So you were really uncomfortable. Would you say you were uncomfortable?
No, it wasn't that I was uncomfortable. It was just that I was very conscious that race was a part of my life.
As opposed to my experience in rural Nebraska, where I just assumed that most people in the world had blonde hair because most of the Disney princesses did, and the people in my world did,
right.
So I was normal.
Sure.
You
okay.
knew you were
yeah,
raced.
Yeah, and it was from the name. There were terms of endearment, and there were the same words used. The tone made the difference, right? White boy was the big one, right? So it was like, what's up, white boy? Or it was like, white boy. And so you knew kind of the severity of welcome or unwelcome based on how that worked. But that was the context in which I grew up and spent a lot of my formative life there. And, you know, I am a product of Shaw, Mississippi, and in a large degree a product of the African-American community there. A lot of the values I have were forged in me early on, and not just Christian values, but human values. Mm-hmm. And I found that there at Mac Evans Elementary and Shaw High School. And, you know, growing up through that and now being kind of creating a critical lens of kind of, it's not nostalgic, it's like, how do I interpret my own history? And what does that mean, not just for me, but maybe a broader audience today, especially with the popularity of the term white trash and how that's used so freely.
Well, you also said in your article that white trash was a new term.
It was. I mean, honky, skank, these were the terms that I grew up with, and some other things I probably can't say here. but white trash was something that came later, and it started off as trailer trash and then mm-hmm. became white trash and then poor white trash. And some of the critical race theory stuff that I do, when you start unpacking that, poor and white are descriptors of trash, and that's what the people are. Mm. And I find that terribly disturbing, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not just, you know, a description of who I am or who maybe I was or whatever, but you were talking now my sister and my mother and my father and my family. So the way that's thrown around willy-nilly, I do think it is kind of a upper class mm-hmm. scapegoating of poor people that makes them feel better about themselves.
I want you to tell,
think that's just atrocious.
I want you to tell this story. Your article says, no matter what school I went to, no matter how much I performed all day after school, no matter how much I performed blackness, mm-hmm. I was always the white boy.
Absolutely.
And you tell a story.
Oh, my goodness. You were talking about the hamburger story. the
yes.
cheeseburger story.
Yes.
So we were all neighborhood kids. We were playing football. And after it was all, I was the white kid playing football. And after it's all over, a friend of mine said, hey, my mom is cooking cheeseburgers. Let's go eat cheeseburgers. And as soon as he said it, like, everybody just stopped and looked at me. And nobody knew if this was okay. And I mean, I don't know how old we were. We weren't teenagers yet, right? So we're tweens, and we are about to navigate some serious racial space. Mm-hmm. And we all know it, but we don't have any kind of vocabulary around it. We're just like, oh, is this okay? Mm-hmm. And Greg goes, yeah, Jason, you too, even you, right? So we all
even
walk.
You, white boy.
Yeah, exactly. We walk in silence to his house. We go in, and she's flipping cheeseburgers on a cast iron grill, and it smells incredible, right? And we all walk in, and she looks at me and just sits in this terrible silence. She keeps on looking at her, you know, flipping her burgers, and she goes, you want a burger? And I go, yes, ma'am. So she made a burger, and she goes, I got a little white boy up in my house. You know? And we're all kind of waiting. She gives me the burger. I eat it. It was fantastic. You want another one? Yes, ma'am. I got a little white boy up in my house. And so she keeps repeating this mantra until finally it goes, I got a little white boy up in my house, right? So it was like her way of kind of dealing. And that was when it was okay. It was like, okay, it's all right. We know that this isn't normal, right? And this has to be in the 80s, right? This is the 1980s. Which for most isn't too long ago, but that's the kind of racial space of the Mississippi Delta during that time period. And a very unique, narrow space because that just did not happen. And it did for us. And I think we all learned something about ourselves and kind of what it means to be a human being in relation to other human beings. Again, we weren't thinking like that as tweens, but my goodness, the kind of weight that kids have to bear because their parents haven't done the work they're supposed to, that's the kind of work that I want to be about now. I want my kids to live in a safer space than that, and I don't want them to have to kind of figure out those kind of racial dynamics on the fly when they're tweens. Right? It's our job to equip them with the language and the vocabulary and the relational IQ to do that well. So, you know, here we are in Mississippi trying to do this stuff. So.
Well, I think it's so interesting to hear you talk, you know, having not grown up around here and you having a different accent than me. And there's really no language for it other than code switching, right? You're code switching between... Yeah, poor white Delta, and then you talk about relational IQ, right? You're switching to the guy with the PhD from Drew and the graduate degree from Yale. And how did that happen? How did that first switch happen? How did you go from that rare little white boy in her house who to becoming the rare boy with your accent at Yale University?
There's some funny stories about that too. There's no real quick story about this, but I became a Christian, and I wasn't raised in a Christian family. My dad was a tough guy, known in town for brawling. He grew weed in the backyard, that kind of stuff, right? And everybody knew I was Kenny's boy. I mean, it was that kind of thing. And so church folks knew to stay away from us. And even years later, I'm pastor in Connecticut, and this little, you know, elderly couple comes to our church one Sunday. That's unusual because our average age was like 42. And after it was over, this guy spoke to me in a very thick Southern accent. And it was the pastor of Shaw Baptist Church who baptized my mother.
No kidding.
Seriously. Brother Brazil.
Oh my.
And Brother Brazil was asking me about how they said, we saw your name and we thought maybe, but we didn't really think it'd be the case, but here you are. And he goes, can I ask you a question? And I go, yes, sir. And he's like, tell me about your dad. And I go, Brother Brazil, my dad is, he's passed now, but at that time he was still alive. And I said, my father goes to church. He's into church these days. And Brother Brazil goes, I mean, no disrespect, son, but I just never thought that would ever be the case, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of family I grew up in. Mm-hmm. And eventually, set of whole other stories, I ended up becoming a Christian, and it was in a Southern Baptist church in the Mississippi Delta, Calvary Baptist Church in Cleveland, Mississippi. And it was a major transformation for me. And when I went to school, there was something that happened, and I thought, oh my gosh, maybe I should honor God in my schoolwork. So I started applying myself, and I actually did really well. So I went to junior college, Mississippi Delta Community College, because it was free. I'd won a carpentry contest in the 11th grade and got a full ride to junior college.
Oh, Jesus of you.
I know. There you go. Exactly. So
you are really taking this fall thing, Jesus, exactly. Seriously.
So went to junior college. That's where I felt called to ministry. Heard about this Baptist school in South Mississippi, William Carey College at the time. They had scholarship for Christian-related vocation. I got scholarship to go there. And it was there where I was studying religion. And I was trying to figure out what seminary to get to, because I knew I was going to go to seminary. It was in New Orleans or Southwestern, because that was as big as my world was. But I was taking Greek and loved biblical languages. I really kind of fell in love with it. And I asked my advisor, you know, where's the best place to study biblical languages? And for me, that was New Orleans or Southwestern. But he answered the question. He goes, probably Yale Divinity School. And
it wasn't on your radar.
It wasn't on my radar. It wasn't on my spectrum. I didn't know if it was affiliated with the Yale that people knew about. I didn't know. Yep.
It's so funny you say that. I had that same experience in rural Nebraska when my advisor said, well, you could go to the Yale Institute of Sacred Music. And I was assuming this was some small thing in rural Minnesota.
Or somebody was using the name.
Exactly.
Yeah, it wasn't real.
It couldn't be this fake world.
So there, I applied and got accepted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, off we went. And then the funny story, here's a great story about class in America. I got there and I started working in work study at the library, which is in a world-class library.
Oh, my goodness, right? Yeah.
And I loved languages, so I was cataloging all these books from different parts of the world. So I was kind of in love with the space. And they paid $7.25 an hour. And I nearly lost my mind. I called my mother, and I didn't have a cell phone, so I ran to my apartment, called my mother and said, Mama, they're paying $7.25 an hour. And she goes, Son, I've never made that much money in my life.
Oh, my God.
And I go, I know.
And it's your work stuff.
I know, and I'm just like, I'm rich.
My gosh.
I'm
sick. Yeah.
Right, so I'm like floating around trying to figure out how much I'm gonna, where am I gonna spend all this money, and then I go eat lunch at the refectory, and this woman, this is round table, she goes, "Can you believe how much they're paying us at work study?" And I go, "Yes, I know, right?" And she goes, "How do they expect us to live on $7.25 an hour?"
No,
and I was just like, I know, right? It was like,
exactly.
But she was, you know, farther down the road than me. But that's when I realized, holy moly, this is real different kind of life experience.
A dollar means something different.
Yeah,
as well.
Man. Yeah. And so that experience. My first couple of weeks at Yale, I realized, all right, I've been negotiating identity all my life, and I can do it here just like I can do it anywhere, right? So that was kind of an awakening early on.
Well, part of that negotiating for you, I feel like, was, you know, navigating your whiteness in a predominantly Black community, and navigating your non-religious nature in a deeply religious community, and making a transition, right?
Sure.
Becoming a Christian. You became a Christian in a Southern Baptist church. You are now a part of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship.
Yeah.
First of all, are those two things the same? Because people don't necessarily know that. And how did that shift happen, and when and why?
So Cooperative Baptist Fellowship is 25 years old this year. We just celebrated 25 years. It split away from the Southern Baptist Convention in the early 90s, I think 1991, 92. Mostly around women in ministry. CBF tends to be a little bit more progressive on some of those kind of issues. But it was a recoil to, you know, Southern Baptist called it the resurgence, Cooperative mm-hmm. Baptist called it the takeover. So, mm-hmm. you know, it depends on what yeah. side you're on as to how you label it. I just didn't know anything about CBF, right? Mm-hmm. I went to seminary because I thought I was going to be a Bible translator. Right. And I wanted to translate from the original languages. Mm-hmm. So that's why I went. I had no intention of not being Southern Baptist. I thought, mm-hmm. go to Yale, get this great master's degree, and then go to New Orleans to get my PhD. Mm-hmm. And when we were finishing up, I was offered a job to be a BSU director at a junior college here in Mississippi. And that was mm-hmm. awesome to me, right? So we got ready to go, put our house on the market. Mm-hmm. And then the guy over at Collegiate Ministry called and said, hey, listen, do you think this is going to be a good fit? And I go, of course. And he goes, well, I mean, after you got that great education, you think you can come back to work with junior college students? Mm. And I was like, I was a junior college student. I know the language, of course. This is kind of my dream. And he said, I don't think it's going to be a good fit. Mm. And the way he said it was so forced. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, well, will there ever be a good fit for me in collegiate ministry in Mississippi? Mm. And he said he did. There's a long, terrible silence. And he goes, I don't think so. And this man was a mentor to me and my wife. Mm. And it was, she told me, I hope there's no little listeners, that she felt like Santa Claus, she just found out Santa Claus wasn't real. Mm. And so we had to find, you know, where do we belong? If we don't belong in Southern Baptist life, mm-hmm. then where are we? And I got a little job. I got a job as an associate pastor at Wilton Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. In Wilton, Connecticut, and I told him, I said, listen, I guess I'm not Southern Baptist anymore because my home state won't have me.
And
they're
like, I'm not in the South.
Yeah. And they were just like, oh, it's fine. We're duly aligned mm-hmm. with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. And that's when I learned about it. Mm-hmm. And so it was a relief mm-hmm. to find a home that was so close mm-hmm. to the home we always had. And that's mm-hmm. how it happened.
And yeah. Susie Painter,
oh my goodness,
is
yeah.
the executive coordinator
yeah.
for CBF.
She's
happen
my
big to be
boss.
A good friend of Susie's. Mm-hmm. We've done a little traveling together. Yeah. She is just amazing. And so, tell us a little bit more. What actually are you doing now with CBF? Yeah.
So I was a pastor in Connecticut for years, and. A year ago, February, I was in my office, and I'm going to go real spiritual with mm-hmm. you here, right?
Good.
Real religious. I'm in my office as a pastor looking at the lectionary passages, and I'm reading Isaiah 58. And it's just the lectionary passage that day. And it's this God telling God's children, your worship is worthless. The worship I desire is to feed the hungry and clothe the naked mm-hmm. and do not forsake your own kin. Mm. And when I read that, I don't know what it was. I was just like, oh my God, I think I have to move back to Mississippi. Now we've lived in Connecticut for 18 years, right?
Oh, no.
And I have
kids
three
there.
Children in great public schools. And mm. you know,
you have forsaken your
man.
Man,
it struck me like a, So I posted this on Facebook, this little passage from Isaiah. And my mother calls me that afternoon, who lives in Alabama now. And this is after my father died. So she's by herself in Alabama. And she goes, Jason, I read that passage from Isaiah, and I think I'm supposed to move back to Mississippi. And I was like, no!
So, wait, your mom is in Alabama.
Yeah,
she's going to move back
exactly.
to Mississippi.
Exactly, because she's a Delta kid, too, Delta girl.
Oh, no.
And after that kind of experience, like within 2 weeks, Susie calls and says, listen, we're trying to combine something here to be the director of Together for Hope and the coordinator of CBF Mississippi. Would that be something you'd be interested in? And I was like, oh my God. So together
Susie, for Susie the angel, man, the little manna from heaven.
She's incredible. She's really an incredible human being. And
so did you have to think about it?
Nope. It was just kind of like, when's it going to happen? And we left our home at Wilton Baptist Church, a church we've been with for 15 years, to come back here. And now I'm over the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship of Mississippi, our state wing of the national office, and the National Rural Development Coalition called Together for Hope.
So what does Together for Hope do?
Together for Hope initially started as our Rural Poverty Initiative in 2001. It was a 20-year commitment to the 20 poorest counties in the country, which are all rural. And so Stephanie Vance has been managing that for a couple of years. She does a great job helping our practitioners do their thing. But they hired me to kind of give a more comprehensive vision for Together for Hope. So using data from the USDA, we are now changing our scale to focus on the 301 counties of persistent rural poverty in America. And I am building a coalition nationwide of nonprofits and churches to combat rural poverty in America. We focus on education, health and nutrition, housing and environment, and social enterprise, which is a new, pretty exciting thing for us, from local farming to creating an economy on a local level to building houses out of local material in South Texas. So
you travel into the Delta now.
I go into the Delta a lot.
And tell us a little bit about, I think our listeners would be very interested. I mean, you say the Delta, we understand what that means, but our listeners don't know what that means.
Okay, so that's Northwest Mississippi, not the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. Okay. That is the biggest
misconception. That's so funny. People think it's the Gulf Coast.
Everybody thinks it's where Mississippi Mississippi River empties into the that kind of river delta, but it's the floodplains. And so the Mississippi Delta is between Mississippi River and the Yazoo River. You know, the old saying from the Peabody Hotel in Memphis to Cotton Row in Vicksburg. That's a Mississippi. The Arkansas and Louisiana also have a delta that's very similar to the Mississippi. I'm from Shaw, Mississippi. So several years ago, we started Delta Hands for Hope, a local organization. We followed assets-based community development, came in, had a town hall meeting, asked the people of the town, not what you need, but what's your assets, what's your strengths? And after an hour of that, everybody was energized. They were like, you know, we forgot we had all this stuff in our town. That's look at all the educational stuff we have for our children, you know. And so we used that momentum and energy then to go back to some identified leaders and say, here's the assets map of Shaw. How do we use this assets map to really kind of build these assets and do some stuff here in Shaw? And it was in that meeting where we ended up coming up with the mission statement for our organization that wasn't even an organization. These leaders said we need to work with kids, K through 12th grade, in education, recreation, health, and spiritual development. And that became Delta Hands for Hope. Within a year, we had an executive director there, and now we have 100 kids in the summer program, a photography and oral history program, a mentor program, a leadership program, a summer food program, a literacy program. It has been incredible. So our kids have been to Yale University to see. There's one kid wanted to said she wanted to be a lawyer, so we went to Yale Law School, and I walked her through those hallowed halls, and I said, "This place is for you."
We had a kid. What a life changing.
Yeah, she's ninth grader in Brescia Towns. She's a fantastic kid. And then this other kid got real into the photography and oral history program. And he started his own photography business. And now he does graduation pictures, weddings.
Oh, my gosh.
And I told CBF, I said, listen, this is our story. Like, bring this kid out to our General Assembly and, like, put him on staff. So two of our kids, Radarius Phillips and Kevion, what's Kevion's last name? Rice. They came over to Atlanta and were our staff photographers for CBF. And then we had a filmmaker out of LA come over and take them to New York and use them as photography assistants in Manhattan and Connecticut.
So cool.
And so these two, I mean, so what we have in rural America is teenagers and human beings that have huge capacity, right? But in rural America, we don't have a lot of opportunity. So what we're trying to do in Together for Hope is match that capacity with opportunity from the network of churches and friends that we have across the country. And it is amazing to see what those how those kids get into it, use it, and and what that how their world expands, right? We've had Japanese exchange students from Ole Miss in the Delta work teaching our kids origami and how to count to 10 in Japanese. We have the Slivka Center at Yale University, mm-hmm. the Jewish Student Life Center, along with the African American Caucus mm-hmm. students. They've come down on joint trips, two spring breaks in a row, to work with our kids. So even when our kids don't get to travel, the world's coming to them now, mm-hmm. and it makes their world bigger. And so that whole travel is the nemesis mm-hmm. to bigotry. It's almost mm-hmm. the reciprocal relationship to that. But our kids are also getting to travel, too.
So and I would say, I mean, beyond that, the Yale students, their world is getting bigger, right? Like, that student in the refectory who said to you, I'm making almost nothing, is seeing that even today, $7.25 an hour is not nothing to some people.
That's exactly right.
Which I think is just that mutually beneficial relationship is just so valuable. It makes me think, you know, you had these experiences and you're a generally energetic person. So I hear your energy around like how much you love these kids and how cool it is what's happening in their lives and how valuable it is to put food on their plates because they can't take pictures if they're hungry.
Right.
But I also heard that in your voice when you talked about what I call dead languages. I hate learning dead languages. And I hear from you that passion for scholarship and writing. First of all, when you write about ancient texts, mm-hmm. Is that something you check at the door of the ivory tower and is useless to you in the real world? Or is there a relationship between your research, your writing, your scholarship, as well as your faith and your relationship to your own spirituality and the hands-on work you do in the world? And if so, what is that relationship?
It's deeply related, mainly because there's this dead language called Koine Greek. Mm-hmm.
And if you cool things are written.
There's some, you translate some of that. You translate, you know, Matthew chapter 25, and you're just like, when mm-hmm. you take care of the most vulnerable in society, you're taking care of mm-hmm. Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. right? But it's not just the language piece that really excited me in translating the Bible and kind of modern applications. But when I started working on my PhD at Drew is a very theory and methods heavy school. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Moore was my advisor there. Brilliant, brilliant mm-hmm. academician. And so that's when I got into post-colonial theory and critical race theory.
Tell us before we go on, what are those things? Talk to me as though I know nothing, because
so
I do, I know nothing
the,
about
the Holy Trinity of post-colonial theory is Homi K. Bhabha, Gayatri mm-hmm. Spivak, and Edward Said, two mm-hmm. Indian scholars and a Palestinian scholar. Mm-hmm. Said's work, Orientalism, is kind of looked at mm-hmm. as the charter document of post-colonial mm-hmm. theory. And all post-colonial theory is analyzing the cultural engagement between a colonizing and colonized country or mm-hmm. culture, right? So Bhabha theorizes that encounter by calling it using terminology like hybridity, mm-hmm. Ambivalence, and mimicry, mm-hmm. which is, these are heavily technical terms within that field, mm-hmm. but basically it is, what is the cultural appropriation and two-way street when colonizer mm-hmm. and colonized mm-hmm. meet? How do colonized people resist? Mm-hmm. What are the many forms that takes, mm-hmm. and how do oppressors oppress in all the different forms that mm-hmm. takes? Mm-hmm. So we use that theory to read the Bible, which was certainly all New Testament in mm-hmm. particular, for me anyway. This is all written by Jews in the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. Yes. And we know what happens in 66 to 70, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
I mean, so what, and John Dominic Crossan writes mm-hmm. about this too.
Yes.
I mean, he is a
brilliant,
a big figure in Empire and X category mm-hmm. of New Testament studies. So you're kind of unpacking that stuff. But for me, all these more theoretical approaches mm-hmm. to interpretation, they all beg an ethical question.
Mm-hmm.
They really do.
Absolutely.
Even though people kind of criticize Bhabha for being too apolitical,
mm-hmm.
This is incredibly mm-hmm. ethical.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets down to, how do we interact as human beings?
Mm-hmm.
And in a hierarchical relationship,
mm-hmm.
how do you exist? How do you resist? How do you transform? Mm-hmm. Saeed was certainly ethical mm-hmm. in everything he wrote. And so that's how, I mean, it shapes the way I understand the world. I think critical race theory mm-hmm. Is doing very similar things with race as the category. It looks mm-hmm. at race as a social construct and mm-hmm. the way society builds value around mm-hmm. skin pigmentation. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from? What are the laws that created it? Mm-hmm. And how that is played out on a daily basis.
And Jason, what role does the Christian tradition play yes. mm-hmm. in affirming those prejudices?
Right.
And again, we've got Charlottesville.
Yeah.
That we're still.
And that's the thing, you know, the Bible, people, it's, I always say the Bible really is innocuous. It's just how we use it. Mm-hmm. And you have people on both sides using the Bible kind of any way they want. Mm-hmm. I do feel like there is an ethic there that is primarily for liberation, specifically the liberation of the oppressed. I took Letty Russell for liberation theology, right? I read James Cone.
I did too.
These guys deeply influenced the way I thought about myself mm-hmm. and thought about the world around me. But I think post-colonial theory, especially the biblical studies, people who use it, tend to be in that liberation trajectory anyway.
Absolutely.
So it is an ethical way to engage scripture mm-hmm. and has everything to do with how we use scripture for mm-hmm. modernity. Right?
Well, I think it just is so clear to me. I say I know nothing about post-colonial theory. I don't compared to you, but you know, it's something I've thought about a lot as someone who had a former title of the director of mission mm-hmm. at a cathedral. And that word mission is really loaded in colonialism and the idea that the missionaries were sent out to these different places to civilize mm-hmm. cultures that were unlike the ones that were the original cultures of the missionaries. And that was a really tricky term for me. I was really uncomfortable with it. And I'm sure has to influence your thinking on a daily basis. One of the terms that comes up in liberation theology for sure, but comes up, I think, more popularly now in the last 3 years is the phrase white savior complex.
Yeah,
and that idea, which is something that I'm sure you're navigating every mm-hmm. single day, as someone who's aware of these theories, that this is not theoretical for you. This is your life.
Exactly. Look, it is, I am, and this is to the credit of being raised where I was raised,
absolutely.
Right? I'm always aware that I'm a white guy.
Yeah.
And this past summer, I drove up with my two children, two of the three children I have, mm-hmm. and we went to the Lakota lands mm-hmm. in South Dakota mm-hmm. and went to the Cheyenne River Reservation to meet with mm-hmm. some of our practitioners there that do this horse therapy with teenagers on mm-hmm. the Lakota land. Mm-hmm. Tony and Byron Buffalo mm-hmm. are saints of God. Mm-hmm. And there are little UCC pastors mm-hmm. in this small congregation in Bridger, South Dakota. And mm-hmm. very aware that mm-hmm. I'm a white guy.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And, but having my kids there as two little white boys, mm-hmm. They got to hang out. There was these two kids, these two little Lakota kids who were there, two boys, and these four guys started mm-hmm. playing and riding bikes and chasing horses mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. And I want to live in that world where that's okay. And watching our kids mm-hmm. be free mm-hmm. without the junk that we kind of mm-hmm. layer on top. It was liberating to see that in them. But to know, God, man, we have a long way to go before they can grow up into something.
Because that's the thing, is in that vacuum with you and mm-hmm. those other kids' parents, you know, that is the way it is. But those four kids are going to get older and they're going to go to a public place together. And suddenly it's you all over again, waiting for that hamburger, not sure if you were supposed to be there.
Exactly.
Well, and all of a sudden I'm just reminded of 1949, Rodgers and Hammerstein produced the musical South Pacific.
Yeah. Mm.
And of course, you know where I'm headed with this. Mm. You have to be carefully taught.
Mm-hmm.
When we were in New Orleans weekend before last, one of the entertainers stood up and recited this. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden you're talking about parents,
yeah.
you're talking about children, your yeah. children, the interaction between the different cultures. And all mm-hmm. of a sudden I'm thinking, and I'm going to read this last line. I think it's important. It says, you have to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before too late, before you are 6 or 7
or 8
yeah. to hate all the people your relatives hate.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be carefully taught.
Mm.
And I look yeah. at those images from mm-hmm. Charlottesville and think mm-hmm. of those, the gentleman who, the young mm. guy who ran, plowed the automobile mm. into
yeah.
those innocent people
yeah.
Who were just supporting, for me, the voice of Jesus, the voice right. of justice, the voice of inclusivity,
yeah.
the voice
yeah.
of welcoming.
Yeah.
And I think, how carefully was he taught
mm-hmm.
to be who he is?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's identity negotiation too, mm-hmm. right? And I look at the folks who are waving the flags and are really angry. They really are angry.
Mm-hmm.
And
afraid.
Yeah, and I just wonder, with the incredulity, the mm-hmm. refusal to believe, that's happened across, you know, kind of these political mm-hmm. spectrums, right? We just cannot talk to each other. We mm-hmm. will not listen to each other.
Which reminds me, Jason, I read an article also this morning that was in the Miami Herald.
Mm.
It was written by Leonard Pitts, Jr., I recommend this article. It was titled, Why Did the Carnage in Charlottesville Happen? Because We Lie to Ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Pitts makes this statement, what happened Saturday in Virginia is the bitter and inevitable fruit of our habit of intellectual dishonesty,
mm-hmm.
where race, particularly where race is concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, I was talking with a guy today who's a young minister. Our church called for his ordination. And just incredible preacher mm-hmm. and good human being. He's African-American, and he wrote a little thing today. So I called him and talked to him, and I sent him some stuff that I wrote. And he goes, listen, my heritage is a heritage of slavery and oppression. Mm-hmm. I have to deal with that. That's mm-hmm. my job. Yours is the history of oppression and hate. Mm-hmm. And that's, white people have to deal with that.
Yep.
He goes, I'm not the expert on your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, white people need to talk about this amongst mm-hmm. themselves and
yeah.
have a conversation mm-hmm. with each other. I'm tired of trying to answer yep. your sins. I was like, I don't know how to... That's not my cultural heritage. That's not, mm-hmm. I mean, I was, you know, I'm here because my ancestors were brought over as slaves, and mm-hmm. and that's my legacy, and I'm trying to deal with that. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know how to deal with mm-hmm. the kind of hatred and superiority complex that white people have. That's your thing, and I would really like, it'd
well,
be great if you guys would deal with it.
Yeah.
You
well,
know, I'm just
that's,
like,
that's exactly, and that's what I, you know, I heard as you were saying, you know, you read that Isaiah passage, and,
mm-hmm.
and you need to return to your kin.
Yeah, yeah.
And it makes me wonder, you know, what is our duty, the three of us gathered here, all being white, of European descent,
mm-hmm.
benefiting every day from those privileges that we benefit from, whether I think the three of us try to be aware of the
yeah.
way we benefit from that, but, like, there are constantly things that we're benefiting from
yeah.
that we don't even notice. And the question becomes, how do we, in the most Christ-like way possible, be true to our kin in the sense of holding ourselves
mm-hmm.
and our people accountable for reckoning with that privilege rather than denying it, and for working toward justice? I mean, it makes me think of what Jesus said to the rich man. It's going to be harder for
mm-hmm.
you to experience God on this earth than it would be for a camel to get through an eye of a needle.
Right.
Or to the rich man, and he said, sell all you have and
mm-hmm.
follow me. We really got a lot of work to do and a lot of humility to figure out and a lot of things to offer up before we can possibly read these texts that, as you say, were written for the oppressed and understand them?
Yeah.
How can we possibly understand the mind of God from our place of shelter and privilege?
Yeah, I'll say this. And when you talk with white people who are poor, they get so angry when they hear white privilege.
Oh, yeah.
And I totally get that.
Oh, I totally get
that. What does it afford us? Mm-hmm. We hate police. Mm-hmm. They hate us. Yeah. They follow us around. Mm-hmm. They profile us. They come get us out of our homes. You know, so they really are kind of baffled at that notion of white privilege, which, you know, I understand it because I came out of that space, right?
Yeah.
I think that there's education that needs to happen. I don't think, and this might just be from my place, right? I think the educated, wealthy, elite white people need to stop scapegoating poor white
people.
I agree.
And if they could recognize that in them own, in their own selves, that would go a long way. Mainly because you have poor people who are demonized for being poor.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that have more relationships with African Americans than anybody else.
Right, right.
I mean, and that really does, that is really a messed up part of white culture,
and
the way poor people
feeds that
are
bitterness
stupid.
And Absolutely. Hatred that leads us to say, but we have to be better than somebody.
The rebel flag, the rebel flag in poor white Southern stuff, that rebel flag is certainly racist.
Absolutely.
But it's also a big middle finger to wealthy Northern people who think they're better, right?
Absolutely.
And there's as much hatred there.
Oh,
there's
a
lot more kind of animosity there than among their neighbors who are probably African American, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're as a white culture trying to fix ourselves, I don't think we need to look at poor white people and say, you need to get your act together. I think it's just the opposite.
Right.
And at the end of the day, on an economic level, the economic inequality is greater now in America than it was during the robber baron period.
Mm.
And the fact is, it is hard to live in America today for most people who aren't in the top 10% of the economic spectrum.
For sure.
So 90% of America, a lot of those people are white, are struggling to make it.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to understand the concept of white privilege in that struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the top 10% who recognize their privilege,
throw that
are trying
around.
To educate
90%. A white savior complex with white people.
That's exactly right. I think that absolutely has something to do with the kind of, I mean, at the end of the day, I have a PhD. My wife has a master's from Columbia, right, in Manhattan. She's Vaden girl.
Yeah.
Vaden, Mississippi, right?
She's
so
amazing.
We're highly educated. We have two full-time jobs. We have insurance and secondary insurance. And we live a little bit better than paycheck to paycheck.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. We're right on that 10% margin.
Mm-hmm.
That's freaking ridiculous.
Yep.
Yeah.
We laugh about this all the time, but we laugh because we're at least on the top 10%.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't be laughing if we were in the 50 percentile.
No.
Wouldn't be funny then.
No.
But that's the country we live in because we favor the wealthy. Yeah. All of our policies favor the wealthy.
Absolutely.
We think they're the ones that's going to save everybody. I mean, that I think is morally reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's gospel. Certainly not according to the letter of James.
Absolutely.
And
So Jason.
Sorry, that's my soapbox.
Yeah,
so
no, I love it. I mean, we have
we're going to have
James,
to get him back for James.
I know.
Yeah.
We have a James expert among us, and Jason knows that that's a favorite of mine as someone who used to use it to, I memorized it in youth group to try and shout down those who had memorized most of the Book of Romans. But it's very true that what I'm hearing in what you're saying is that that work with the gospel and that work with these ancient texts and this work of following Jesus is inextricably bound in the education that you've had. And I don't mean the education that you had in the corridors of Yale University any more than I mean the education that you had in Shaw, Mississippi.
Absolutely.
And how these things go hand in hand and hold us together as whole people and generate the work that we're each individually called to and can do, that we're able to return to our kin.
And there's opportunity for us to educate ourselves. Mm-hmm. You don't have to actually go to Yale University.
Yeah, exactly.
But, welcome to the internet age.
Yeah. Well, and the other, I did want to mention one other piece of literature that I think is very important. If people really want to know the background, the history, the struggle, and it's a book, it was actually or is on the New York Times bestseller list. It's by Nancy Eisenberg. Mm-hmm. And Jason, I saw you looking at it earlier.
Yeah,
the title is White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. Mm-hmm. I've read just the first little part of it. And I think this book should be a required reading for every student in this country. Mm-hmm. And I would love for every adult to pick this book up and read it. It's shocking. Mm-hmm.
And just, there's a whole body of literature called whiteness studies that is, you know, fairly recent in academic terms, you know, 15, 20 years tops. There's a book of essays called White Trash. There's just a lot there. Mm-hmm. The Invention of the White Race is a two-volume work.
A lot of exploration right now around white fragility.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that is all important work, to kind of unpack what that identity is and what that looks like.
Thank you, Jason. Before we bring our podcast to a close, I'd like to share something that a dear and close friend said to me this weekend. She said, "I believe that if more Christians got clearer on what kind of person Jesus really was and what kinds of things he did, and if they saw more clearly how little emphasis he gave to a lot of what churches and their doctrines and Bible interpretations now emphasize, they would see more need to focus instead on the justice issues that relate so closely to Jesus's teachings. I know that this change can happen, and in fact, often does happen, because it has happened to me and to many other Christians I hear from and read about." And here at Faith and Reason, we are about to release a new educational series titled The Challenge of Paul. It features John Dominic Crossan. And this series provides the very kind of corrective thinking many of us throughout the world are imagining and longing for.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful piece that I'll have to keep my eyes out for. I bet I know where I can find it. but Jason, thank you so much for joining us today. And I just have to say that I'm so glad that you have indeed returned to Mississippi. And it's, you know, fun to also reminisce about the shape of the chapel at Yale and things like that with you. But it's really remarkable to see the work that you're doing and to hear about it as it really truly has impacted our community in your short time that you've been back.
Well, I'll just say this, if you permit.
Yeah.
I've been back about a year, and what has utterly impressed me about Mississippi is the fact that there are so many good people at work here.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? They've been doing this the 18 years I've been gone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And it is an honor and privilege to come back to this state and work with people who were doing this work a long time before I got here.
Absolutely.
And I get to join in now. It really is a privilege.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel the exact same way. And so please join us again anytime and bring any of your wonderful colleagues who've been doing this work. That'd be great.
That would be fun. Yeah. I'd love to hear from them too. Some of the children, you could bring them from the
Delta.
That'd be
awesome.
So fun. That would be great. Well, please visit our website at faithandreason.org. That is faithandreason.org, where you can make a donation to support our programs, subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, or find materials like The Challenge of Paul for use in individual and group educational settings.
This program is produced by Faith and Reason, a program of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation.